Yes, 25. Okay. Please repeat. Avyaktaha ayam achintyaha ayam avikaryaha ayam uchyate tasmat evam viditva enam na anusochitum arhasi avyaktoyam achintyoyam avikaryoyam uchyate tasmat evang viditvenam nanu sochitum arhasi nanu sochitum arhasi avyaktoyam achintyoyam avikaryoyam uchyate tasmat evang viditvenam nanu sochitum arhasi avyaktoyam achintyoyam avikaryoyam uchyate tasmat evang viditvenam nanu sochitum arhasi nanu sochitum avyaktoyam achintyoyam avikaryoyam uchyate tasmat evang viditvenam nanu sochitum arhasi avyaktaha invisible ayam this soul achintyaha inconceivable ayam this soul avikaryaha unchangeable ayam this soul uchyate is said tasmat therefore evam like this viditva knowing it well enam this soul na do not anusochitum to lament arhasi you deserve. Translation: it is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. Purport: as described previously, the magnitude of the soul is so small for our material calculation that he cannot be seen even by the most powerful microscope. Therefore, he is invisible. As far as the soul's existence is concerned, no one can establish his existence experimentally beyond the proof of Shruti or Vedic wisdom. We have to accept this truth because there is no other source of understanding the existence of the soul, although it is a fact by perception. There are many things which we have to accept solely on grounds of superior authority. No one can deny the existence of his father based upon the authority of his mother. There is no source of understanding the identity of the father except by the authority of the mother. Similarly, there is no source of understanding the soul except by studying the Vedas. In other words, the soul is inconceivable by human experimental knowledge. The soul is consciousness and conscious. That also is the statement of the Vedas. And we have to accept that. Unlike the bodily changes, there is no change in the soul. As eternally unchangeable, the soul remains atomic in comparison to the infinite, supreme soul. The supreme soul is infinite, and the atomic soul is infinitesimal. Therefore, the infinitesimal soul, being unchangeable, can never become equal to the infinite soul, or the supreme personality of Godhead. This concept is repeated in the Vedas in different ways just to confirm the stability of the conception of the soul. Repetition of something is necessary in order that we understand the matter thoroughly without error. Om Agyana Timarandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadhati Svapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutha Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raganatam Vitam Tang Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitangscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bhando Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavanishwari Vrishabhanu Sutadevi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanshakalpata Rubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadhadhar Srivasadi Ghora Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Avyaktoyam achintyoyam avikaryoyam uchate, tasmat evam viditvenam nanu sochitum arhasi. So when I was reading the beginning of the purport, I was thinking, oh, it's the same. Because if you read in text 22, the purport, change of body by the atomic individual soul is an accepted fact. Even the modern scientists who do not believe in the existence of the soul, but at the same time cannot explain the source of energy from the heart, have to accept changes of body which appear from childhood to boyhood, from youth to, and again, from youth to old age. Anyway, it's a little bit similar. It speaks about the atomic soul. And here also, and it's also very similar to the previous verse. Luckily, I prepared this class actually a little bit. I usually don't do that. But I was reading in Burjan's book that, and Prabhupada explains it actually, because, you know, Prabhupada's purports are basically out of this world. They're completely transcendental. And yeah, I don't know. It is kind of miraculous. I never heard of any author that was reading his own books, or that was asking other people to read the books back to him. You know, Prabhupada could really enjoy people reading from Bhagavad Gita, and sometimes he would quote a verse and then he would ask his disciples read the purport, and he was listening like it wasn't his own purport. And in fact, sometimes he said that these purports are not my purports. They're directly given by Krishna. And I tell you honestly, I've been studying this Bhagavad Gita on and off for 15 years. And just looking on these purports, you know, you can just see that they are like perfect. I mean, you can just feel it. I mean, that is my personal experience. Yeah, so here the purport starts. As described previously, the magnitude of the soul is so small for our material calculation that it cannot be seen even by the most powerful microscope. I just want to see. If I know that Sariya Rasa, she lectured on that particular thing. That was with Govardhan, no? Oh, here it is, I think. Yeah, it's that purport from the Upanishads. You see? That it is... I think it's even further back. Yeah, here it is. It is text 17. So we should study this Bhagavad Gita. We should not just read it. Prabhupada says, as described previously. So that described previously, as far as I can see, is text 17. Right? And that is... Prabhupada sometimes also used to say that actually more important than the verses are the purports. Because these verses, especially these particular verses, if you look, for instance, at probably also 17, I'm not sure. Let me find another example for you, so you might get that point. Well, what I want to say is that this is called also Gita Upanishad. And it's sometimes considered one of the Upanishads. I don't know if you ever read Sri Upanishad. You read it, right? Have you read it? Have you seen it? Anyway, it's a very important book. It's part of the Bhakti Shastri. And I distributed hundreds, if not thousands of them on the streets in Holland. And without reading it, to be honest. I mean, I read it kind of, but I never really studied it. But just recently I was talking with a friend, and he memorized every single verse. He said, yeah, we distributed thousands of these books, and we never read them. He said, I start studying it, and I was totally ecstatic. And he knows every single verse. It's part of his sadhana. He memorizes them every day. Anyway, the point is that... The Bhagavad Gita is also like an Upanishad. Oh, here you can see it. Text number 20, just to prove my point. Najayate mriyate vakada chin. I think you also have to know this for Bhakti Shastri. I'm not 100% sure, but... You have 220? Yes? There you go. So, watch carefully. Or better, listen carefully. Nayam budva bhavita vana buyaha. Ajo nitya shashvato yampurano nahanyate hanyamane sharire. Now look at the Katha Upanishad in the purport. You see that? 1-18? The same verse, almost the same. You see that? Najayate mriyate va vipachin. That's the difference. It's the only difference. Nayam kuthaschin. That is another difference. Na babuva kaschit. So that's a little different. Then again, exactly the same. Ajo nicha shashvato yam purano nahanyate hanyamane sharire. Exactly the same. So the point is that everybody knows generally that you cannot really understand Upanishads. They are they are called, as far as I understand, the headlines of the Vedas. Like if you read a headline, tsunami in Japan or something, you don't really know what happened. I mean, unless we know now what happened because we've read the news or we heard from friends. But if you read it and you don't even know what a tsunami is, then you know nothing, you know. You have to read the article. It's a big wave. It was 50 meters high. It devastated so many this, that, like that. So it's the same with these Upanishads, and the Gita, Bhagavad Gita, is in fact not really an exception. And we know that actually. I studied the Bhagavad Gita from Aldous Huxley. And it was basically totally confusing. I think it was Aldous Huxley. Yeah, he's got his own Gita. Yeah. Pretty sure it was him. Yeah, I was a big fan of his work, you know. So especially The Doors of Perception. You must have heard of that. This famous rock band, The Doors. They called themselves to that book. And the book was about... It's a little bit important to touch upon it because it was a big book in the hippie movement. I mean, the fact that The Doors named themselves after them proves it. From Aldous Huxley. Oh, you see, he was already reading on moksha as a Sanskrit word. But this particular book is a very famous book in the 60s, and it describes, for instance, also about this famous Dutch painter, Van Gogh. I don't know if you ever saw his paintings. It's got all these stripes. And people know, actually, that he was, in fact, crazy. He cut off his ear. And the idea is what some experts and Huxley also said, that he was kind of tripping. He was kind of in another reality, and that's why he was painting like that, you see? So he saw another reality, thus the word doors of perception. Now, the hippies, they were saying you can take LSD and then you can enter these doors. Or you can take a lot of drugs, you can enter these doors. This is, of course, all nonsense, as we know now. But it was, and it's still a big thing in the kind of Mayavad philosophy. And so this Aldous Huxley, he was saying these kind of crazy things. Let me quickly defeat it because it's such a poisonous thing. Let me see if I can do it. It's not so easy to defeat it. At least for me, because I used to believe in it. The idea is that... one of the arguments that the hippies used, the Hare Krishna hippies, the hippies that turned... They said, yes, you go high, but you have to come down. This is very basic. Any hippie can understand it. You take the LSD, you can enter maybe the doors of perception, but then you have to go back. Or worse, you can die. No? Anyway, I don't want to bore you with all kinds of LSD stories. But it's dangerous. Anyway, the point is that no matter how high you get or which door you go in, generally you have to go out. And Prabhupada gives another argument. He says, if a drug can make you experience God, then he argued, then the drug is more powerful than God. And in one sense it's also true, except maybe for ecstasy, but that you can't really perceive, you don't get very spiritual from it. It's a different type of drug. But most drugs, they trigger some chemical in your head, and then you start to alter reality. So the point is that it's already there in your body, and in fact it is given by God. But anyway, the whole idea of using a drug and to reach God, it's not possible. Ultimately, God is in control. And he reveals himself to anybody he likes. So it's possible you take LSD and you have some experience of God. But it's not because of the LSD. It's because something from your previous lives or previous life. Anyway, so that whole theory is bogus. My point I wanted to make quickly is that Aldous Huxley, he wrote his Bhagavad Gita and you couldn't understand it. Really. You couldn't understand that you had to surrender to Krishna, that you had to become a devotee, man mana bhavamat bhakto. You couldn't, from his explanation, you couldn't understand that you should think of Krishna, you should become his devotee, you should worship him, namaskuru, namaskar, man mano bhavamat bhakto, majaji and jaji, worship him, like yagya, jaji, majaji. So, that is my point, that the Bhagavad Gita, here you can see, I more or less proved it, it is like an Upanishad, and without these purports, you can really not understand it, actually. Especially, without the Bhaktivedanta purports, because there's also other purports. And Prabhupada says, if they say, and they meaning his God brothers, if they say one word different, the whole thing can be spoiled. So, you know, I'll tell you one more story clarifies that point. When Hayagriva and Kirtanananda came with Srila Prabhupada to India, to Vrindavan, they thought, now we're going to meet hundreds and thousands of devotees like Srila Prabhupada, because we're going to Vrindavan, and they're all devotees of Krishna, you know? And they came, and they were I don't know if they were disappointed, but what they said was, they saw devotees of Krishna, but they saw nobody was like Prabhupada. You see, nobody could compare to Srila Prabhupada. That's what their realization was from their own experience. So, that is their experience, but I can tell you from my own experience that these purports are really amazing. And it's better just to stick to these purports than to other purports. So please now go to text 17. Because that is what Prabhupada refers to. The verse today, I'll just refresh your mind. As described previously, the magnitude of the soul is so small for our material calculation that it cannot be seen even by the most powerful microscope. So here in this purport, it is quoted from the Svetashvara Upanishad, Balakrashata Bhagasya Satada Kalpitasya Cha Bhago Jiva Cha Vigyeya Sa Chanadjaya Kalpate. When the upper point of a hair is divided into 100 parts, And again, each of such parts is further divided into 100 parts. Each such part is the measurement of the dimension of the spirit soul. Now, there's two things that I want to explain. Is the first thing is that the soul is spiritual, it's transcendental. Transcendental means non-material. Prabhupada wrote a book, Easy Journey to Other Planets, and he describes the soul as being non-material. So in that sense, the soul cannot be measured by any instrument because the instrument is material. You see? But I looked it up in Wikipedia, we had a whole discussion, and this seems to be to come pretty close, actually. Oh, okay. Well, let us know. You want to get the mic, so our internet listeners can enjoy. So, you have to come a little bit closer.
Okay. So, in my research, here's what I found. So the diameter of the human hair is between 17 and 181 microns, which is basically 1 micron is 10 to the minus 6 meters, so it's 1 millionth of a meter. So the human size of the human hair diameter is in the range of 10 to the minus 4 or 1/10,000th of the meter is the actual diameter. So, actually, if you divide that by 10,000, so that would be 10 to the minus 8, which is the size of viruses, it turns out. So the size of viruses is between 20 nanometer to 450 nanometer. Like the HIV virus, for example, is 90 nanometer, in the range of 10 to the minus 8. So that would be, it would be actually a virus, that's it. So, and then you have the next one is the atom, like for example, the hydrogen, radius of the hydrogen atom, I found to be 25 picometers. That's 1 pico is 10 to the minus 12 meters. So, but atoms in general, because hydrogen is the smallest, of course, so the rest is bigger, so it's in the range of the angstrom. The angstrom is 10 to the minus 10 meters. So, and then protons, there was the classical theory, which doesn't involve quantum mechanics, that said 10 to the minus 15 meters, but that's not correct actually, because you have to take into account quantum mechanics, which would make it less, of course. So proton is 1.6 to 1.7 fathometers, which is, anyways, it's around 10 to the minus 15. And quark is 10 to the minus 18 meters, and then you have the electron, that's 10 to the minus 22 meters. And the Planck length, which is the smallest imaginable physical length, is 10 to the minus 35. That's the range of, you know, like anything. So the question is that, yeah. So the question is what they mean by this tip of the hair, because if we go back to the size of the atom, which was around the angstrom size, or 100 picometers, so that's 10 to the minus 10 meters, which is like 1/10 billionth of the meter. So that's the general radii of the atoms. So that if you multiply that by 10,000, of course, then you would get 10 to the minus 6, which is 1 millionth of a meter. So if the diameter of the hair was, as it said, between 17 and 181 micrometers or microns, then it would mean that the tip of the hair would be 1/100th of the diameter of the hair. In that case, you get the correct figure for the atom in the range of 10,000th of the tip of the hair in terms of measurable microscopic size. If you take that to be, because you like Sharadiya Rasa Devi Dasi said that the tip is going smaller and smaller. That you can't exactly know how small the tip is. But we found only measurements for the diameter. So if the tip is smaller, then the diameter, then you know, it's like you could take it if you want to adjust the numbers to fit the size, the currently measured size of the atom, because it's in the range of the angstrom. It's called the angstrom. It's an old kind of measurement. So that's anyway, one angstrom is 10 to the minus 10 meters or 100 picometers. The hydrogen, for example, being 25 picometers, but that's the smallest atom. So the rest is obviously bigger. It's more like, on average, atoms are in the range of 100 pico or picometers, which is, as I said, 10 to the minus 10 meters. That's the range. And the hair diameter is the range of 10 to the minus 4. So maybe the tip of the hair is 10 to the minus 6 meters, and then everything's fine. Any comments?
Yeah, I kind of already anticipated on that. Although it's still for me a question. You're saying 10 to the 6th, but could you say that the tip of a hair is 100 times smaller than the diameter? I don't know. It could be 1,000 times smaller. It could be 10,000 times smaller. It could even be more, no? I don't know. Tip is, you know. And a tip is also, what is a tip, you know? But anyway, that is still kind of the question. I'm sure some scientists, they might have an answer. It is already interesting that these scientists, they give the diameter. So it seems that maybe they are already... it's not possible for them to give us the range of the tip of a hair. But I must admit that if I hear this, then it sounds that this angstrom or whatever it's called is smaller than what they describe in here. Right? Yes. But like I said in the beginning, first of all, it's transcendental. And second of all, another explanation that is sometimes given, that they just give an idea. This is an idea, so the soul can be smaller. You see, this is just an... Because when it comes to these kind of things, it gets kind of technical, because you're going to try to put something spiritual into... how shall I explain this? Well, you're trying to describe something into material terms, and then it gets tricky, because these texts are, you know, billions of years old, eternal, and I don't know, it gets kind of tricky. And we've seen the same thing with the universe. Sariputta wrote a whole book about it, that it's basically, he calls it demigods, yojanas, and that there's different dimensions. Like we have, for instance, here, we become 100 year, but Brahma also becomes 100 year, but the time goes much slower there. And for instance, in the spiritual world, one breath of Lord Vishnu is like a whole lifetime of Lord Brahma. So in spiritual world, even goes slower. And there, of course, there is also no time factor. So there's the time doesn't destroy or anything. But it also goes like so slow that, like Prabhupada says, if you go back, it's like you've been away for 5 minutes. But you know, the way I understand it is that you're coming back, and then they're going like, "Hi, did you saw Krishna? You saw that?" And you're like, "No, what?" You're like totally like, "Oh, I missed it, you know. I'm never gonna go away anymore." Anyway, I don't know if you ever went to like a movie theater and you missed the beginning of the movie. You're like, "Oh my God, you know, I might as well leave now, you know." So it's gonna be like that when you come back to the spiritual world. No, but don't leave. anyway, so yeah, so it seems that it remains a bit of a controversial topic still, but at the same time they come very close. I mean, they really come into the range of the smallest part. It's not that they are, like, you know, way off. So at least we can say they knew what they were talking about when they said it's the smallest part. They weren't talking in meters, you know. They were talking really small. Anyway, so this is just the purport where it explains. It's a little bit of a long explanation. What Prabhupada says, as described previously, the magnitude of the soul is so small for our material calculation that it cannot even be seen by the most powerful microscope. Therefore, he is invisible. Of course, we read in Krishna book that sometimes the demons, they die, and that the soul comes out of the body and he enters Krishna's body. But maybe that's just extraordinary because those souls are more or less liberated, so maybe that's why you can see it, or maybe because Krishna is there. I don't know how that works exactly. Okay. Any questions on this particular thing? Any more questions? About the soul being invisible? No? Okay. As far as the soul existence is concerned, no one can establish his existence experimentally beyond the proof of Shruti or Vedic wisdom. So how does it exist? We have to accept this truth. Because there is no other source of understanding the existence of the soul, although it is a fact by perception. The fact is that you are conscious. That is the symptom of the soul. And therefore, the symptom is there, therefore the cause must be there, which is the soul. There are many things we have to accept solely on grounds of superior authority. Yeah, so, I don't know, have you ever been in America? Yes? And you? Oh, okay. I'm asking the wrong people. Have you ever been to Canada? Yeah. You've been in Canada. Okay. Anyway, any country where you haven't been, right? Antarctica, right? Well, that is not a very good example. Take another example, like, I don't know, Mexico. You know it's there. You've never been there, but you know it's there because you accept authority. You have like a travel agency. You have history. You have, I don't know, people who've been there. But you've never been there. You haven't seen it. But you trust them. It's that simple. It's not rocket science. So it's the same with the soul. You can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't taste it. But because you like, especially people who spoke with Srila Prabhupada, there, because it is explained in the fourth chapter, Tattva Darshina, those who have seen the truth, they can explain it to you. You know, if you meet a person like that, or you meet any of the ISKCON gurus, you can also feel that they're very spiritual. So if people like that tell you the soul exists, then it really enters your heart, and you, because they say it with conviction, with realization, and you just have to accept it ultimately. I mean, it's not that you accept it blindly, but like Mexico, if you haven't been there, you just have to accept it. I mean, what's the big deal? You know, but with the soul, suddenly we all get like esoteric and philosophical, but it's the same principle. It's not different. Yeah, China exists. We've never been in China. I almost was on a plane to Hong Kong, but I never made it. Australia. I've been in Australia. It's a nice country. Anyway, and it's called Shruti. Shruti is like Shravanam. It's hearing. Shruti, and now it gets very interesting. There are many things we have to accept solely on grounds of superior authority. No one can deny the existence of his father. This is the example Srila Prabhupada gives. Now, of course, nowadays, like when I gave lecture in Amsterdam, then this whole DNA came up and people were like, yeah, but now you can see the DNA and you don't need the father anymore. But, of course, there is some truth in it. But the point is, if you want to know, for instance, how your father used to smell or what kind of girlfriends he had, or other details like that, then you have to ask your mother. She's basically the only person who can really tell you. So that is kind of the idea, you see. And ultimately also, I mean, you can do a DNA test, that's true. But ultimately she can also tell you who's the father. So it's an example. An example is as good as the comparisons. But there's many comparisons. So the example, I think we can still much use it, only we can sometimes elaborate a little bit on the explanation in order to defeat like so-called, you know, scholarly persons who come up with these kind of weird arguments. There is no source of understanding the identity of the father except by the authority of the mother. So it's not only the identity that this is your father, but the identity that he had a beard, he was, you know, he was getting drunk, or he wasn't, he was a devotee, or whatever. Similarly, there's no source of understanding to understanding the soul except by studying the Vedas. So the Vedas is called like the mother, like that. In other words, the soul is inconceivable by human experimental knowledge. Yeah, so we talked about kind of, well, I don't want to call Huxley a yogi, but he was doing yoga, and other people, they can, I also did yoga, and you can kind of experience the soul, and you can have some idea of it, but until you read the Bhagavad Gita, it's going to be very, very vague. And especially, like I explained in the beginning of the class, until you read Prabhupada's purports. Because I used to read Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, but I didn't like his purports because, you know, I was smoking and doing so many other nonsense. So I was just reading the translations, you know. And so it took me a long time. Then when once I started to read the purports, then it was, you know, I couldn't argue with Prabhupada anymore. He was defeating all my arguments. So the Vedas is like the mother, and we have to accept it. The soul is consciousness and conscious. It is conscious. Soul is conscious. I'm conscious of my leg. And the soul is consciousness. It is almost inconceivable. Anyway, you can meditate on that. It's consciousness and conscious. Unlike the bodily changes, there's no change in the soul. Yeah, so Prabhupada, he goes, invisible, he explained. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. So he explained invisible. We explained inconceivable. Now he's explaining immutable. Now he's going to another topic. Unlike the bodily changes, there is no change in the soul. And as eternally unchangeable, the soul remains atomic in comparison to the infinite. Now, this is another important point. Here Prabhupada again preaches against the Mayavad philosophy. He says the soul always stays small and God always stays great. As the Muslims say, Allahu Akbar, infinite, unlimited. And the soul is limited or smallest. The Supreme Soul is infinite and the atomic soul is infinitesimal. Infinitesimal means that it cannot be broken up. Like we're discussing, smaller, smaller, smaller. But try to accept that the soul is the smallest. It's very important that you understand that. Well, infinitesimal means that that's where it stops. Because the scientists, they have this theory that it goes on infinitely, but it doesn't. Like they also say that the universe goes on until infinitely. But we know, we have information from the Vedas that there is a covering. First of all, there's called Loka Loka Mountain. That is where the sunlight bounces off against. And then, and it is like the half of the universe. And then behind that local, local mountain, there's another, the half of the universe, which is basically completely dark. And then after that, there is the first layer, Earth, 10 times bigger than the whole universe. Second layer, water, not really water, like, you know, the element of water, 10 times bigger than Earth, like that. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, ego. Then there's, you know, if you read the Bhagavatam, there's more layers even. And one devotee said then, and at the end, there's Maya standing, and she offers you anything you want. Once you escape, she's not there trying to bring you back and like catching you, but she's trying to bring you back with allurements. You know, you can become Lord Brahma, you know, anything you want. Anyway, the point is, it's very important that you understand it. There is nothing smaller than the soul. This is the idea. So please try to understand that. Therefore, the infinitesimal soul, being unchangeable, can never become equal to the infinite soul or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This concept is repeated in the Vedas in different ways just to confirm the stability of the conception of the soul. Repetition of something is necessary in order that we understand the matter thoroughly without error. So it's what I said in the beginning, that Abhurijan explained it, that this verse is repeating the other verses throughout this section. Bhaktivinoda explained that this whole section describes about the soul. Starting from, text 17, or even before, text 17. From text 17 on till this 25, it is just, Krishna is explaining again and again about the soul. And Burjan explains, this is for tomorrow, atacha. If, however, also, this is another point Krishna is making. Now he's going to explain about if you think that the soul is always born and dies forever, he's going to speak materially now. So he spoke spiritually. I explained to you about the Upanishads. He was basically literally repeating the Upanishads. But this is the funny thing about Krishna. Krishna is also a devotee. Krishna likes to listen to Bhagavad Gita. He likes kirtan. He likes, it's a little bit strange to say prasadam, but more or less, because everything Radharani makes is instant prasadam. All the things that devotees like, Krishna also likes. He likes flower garlands, he likes cows, he likes sweets. So Krishna is also a devotee. And he likes scriptures, so he also quotes the scriptures. So anyway, that is important for tomorrow. Tomorrow it will be more material knowledge, and this was all spiritual. And it's repeating. That is, it is good to repeat a good difficult thing. So, any questions, comments? Yeah, but I think what is the most important about this word, infinitesimal, that you cannot divide it anymore. Because we just talked about this whole material thing, and then there's this, and then there's this, and then there's something even smaller and something. But it stops here with the soul. That's it. And like with God, God is, unlike the material universe, the spiritual universe is, of course, unending. There's no end there. But for the spirit soul, us, we cannot conceive it because we are finite. And actually Krishna also can't conceive it. At the same time he can. It's like he was looking at this beauty and then he got bewildered. He was looking in the stone. You have that picture, remember? And he got bewildered. Anyway, so we'll stop there. Chant Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Gaur Bhaktivrinda ki jai.
Easy.
This one?